Welcome to episode 33 of Gallifrey Public Radio. You either loved it or you hated it, but we can all agree that the moped was awful. This week we talk about the Rings of Akaten. But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Whitten.
We need somebody who is more intense.
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
Perfect Hoogan name.
And Keir Hansen.
I'm holding up for catfight.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 33 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we sing the entire time, lest the mummy alien wake up and call the god planet sun thing to eat all our emotions.
Arrgh.
I'm Jay, and with me as always are Keir and Melissa. How are you guys doing tonight?
Howdy.
Fantastic.
Right, well, we have some stuff to talk about.
We do.
This was a very, very divisive episode. It's definitely like the sushi of Doctor Who. You either absolutely loved it or couldn't stand it. But before we get to that, we actually have some news.
Well, that's news.
We have a lot of news, and I think we should say, starting now, there's a lot of stuff about the 50th anniversary special coming out, and we're going to talk about most of it. So if someone, skip ahead if you don't want to hear anything about that. I don't know how you can avoid it, but I just, fair warning, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. So what is our news, guys?
Well, as people have been slowly levitating about, both online and around the City of London right now, as production is underway in downtown London for the 50th, along with, as we reported last time around, the arrival of Billy Piper and David Tennant to be added to the script, there are now these beautiful, beautiful shots of some of their production photos and even some video clips provided from Block to Who and a couple of other people who were allowed to be on set a little closer than the public, being kept at, a very long pole's distance behind hurricane barriers and things like that. So we're seeing all kinds of interesting shots that don't – no, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you guys have looked them over. Are you able to ascertain anything from some of the actual – shots during filming, not just the incidentals of them standing next to a Land Rover and that kind of thing?
Not really. I mean, the only thing, and I mean, this is a huge stretch, but all that's going around is, like, some people are saying, oh, well, Billy Piper wasn't on set today, so clearly she's trapped in an alternate dimension, and there's just that. And it's like, maybe she just...
Reaching.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of that going around, and the only thing that I saw that I could think possibly would indicate something is there's a lot of discussion going on about whether or not it's going to be the, handy doctor from the alternate universe or actually the 10th doctor from an earlier time. So, a lot of people are on both sides of the fence about that, which one they prefer and things like that. But, if you look at the pictures, then the 10th doctor is in his brown pinstripe suit, which is the one that the actual doctor was wearing, and Handy Doctor got the blue suit. So maybe it means something. Maybe it's just that the brown suit's more popular and they decided to stick with it. I'm sure they've got tailors over in, Earth 2, but who knows?
I personally will say at least that much, that is a conscious decision when it comes to the wardrobe selections. If they were that careful about the color of bow ties through previous season, and they're going to pay attention to Tennant's entire suit selection at this point.
Well, what I want to say is, speaking of costumes and, the costume department obviously is so conscientious. I think that the pictures that we have seen, the costumes give a lot away. Have you guys seen this with the Queen Elizabeth? And because, like you said, with his suit, that could give away everything. But, we could know right now that really is the doctor, if it turns out to be true. And so I think there's someone dressed, I believe, as Queen Elizabeth, which I think, she's been mentioned on the show a bunch of times, which would be awesome to bring her back. But I think that's a really, that's a spoiler.
Well,
that's a big.
Well, you got to think, this is stuff that they're approving to come out. These are photos that you know, they haven't taken down and, you know, done a cease and desist. So I don't think that it's a huge plot point, just like the fact that we've got the Zygons. I don't think, you know, the Zygons aren't going to be the main bad guy in this special. You know, they're going to make an appearance. They might play an integral role in it, but they're not going to be the main bad guy. They're holding that back. They're not going to let us know that this early on. So I think the fact that Queen Elizabeth is in it is probably going to be a cameo or, you know, something to wrap up some comment someone made 4 years ago. Yeah, but I don't think it's a major plot point.
No.
Okay.
But it is nonetheless interesting, and we latch on to it like we do everything else.
Well, we're Whovians. It's what we do.
Mm-hmm. Now, do we want to do a little rearrangement on some of the other related news here as far as the production for the 50th and who we know is in as well as who we know is out? How do you want to tackle this?
Well,
go for it. You brought it up now.
Well, I'm asking, do we want the good news or the bad news?
Well, let's go ahead and get the bad news out of the way. This kind of the first piece kind of broke right after we recorded last week that Chris Eccleston has declined to be in the 50th anniversary. He spoke with Stephen Moffat. They met. They discussed it and everything like that. And at the end, apparently Chris Eccleston just said, you know, it's just not what I want to do right now. There was a lot of rumor flying around that he was originally in it and then quit. And both Stephen Moffat and Chris Eccleston have come forward and say, no, that's not the case. We met. We discussed it. It just wasn't the right time. Yeah. So we will not have the Ninth Doctor.
Continue to wonder what goes through the mind of Christopher Eccleston. I just don't understand.
Well, I mean, he's got a lot of work going on right now with Thor 2. So, you know, it might just be that he didn't see this as worth taking a time away from that.
True.
Yeah.
I don't know. But even worse, as we were starting to, well, we had almost resigned to it, but we were keeping hope alive that we would continue to see some of our earlier iterations of our good doctor. And we now have the confirmation that we will not be seeing 6th, 7th, or 8th doctors appearing in the special either, at least in their current aged and slightly larger forms.
Colin Baker!
Yes, our beloved Colin Baker has apparently been on the inverse Subway diet and now is actually eating Subway cars. I don't know. But we were kind of hoping that they would figure out some way to, even if it was a matter of cameo appearances or quick walk-ons or just anything to get them on screen, that they would have had some involvement. But apparently that's not even going to be the case as well. So whatever it is that Moffat has up his sleeve that he has already told us that he is going to be acknowledging, if not involving, the previous doctors in some fashion, now that begs the question, what fashion is that?
Right.
I think because they still can use footage, old footage, so I think they, you know.
Yeah, it'd be like sort of a clip sequence flashback to instances that our current doctor is looking back on to try and solve some issue that transcends his regenerations, I guess, or something. I'm grasping at straws here.
I got you.
The fact that we don't have the 6th, 7th, and 8th doctors in it kind of makes me happier that Chris Eccleston is not going to be in it, because if they did that, it would just seem like they were completely snubbing anything from the classic series. You know, if you had the 9th, 10th, and 11th doctors but didn't include anyone else, it would just kind of seem like, yeah, we know that, you know, you're what got us to 50 now, but we don't care. So the fact that it's just going to be 10 and 11 makes it more, you know, it seems like they're just trying to be more current as opposed to excluding everything that came before.
I suppose. You know, I don't know if they're necessarily looking at it from a, well, here are our two ratings cash cows. Or anything that sort of thing. Like, there's probably more to it, but
I'm just saying this is what I tell myself to get over the pain of Eccleston not being in it.
Yeah. Understandable.
But we do know who is in it,
Yes, and we do.
So psyched to hear that this happened. Absolutely. Is that we will be having the young Brig, the big Brig,
Lady Brig.
I like baby Brig better. The Brig baby. Kate Stewart, Jenna Redgrave will be returning, and Gemma she was enthusiastic to be involved again right after they had originally shot Power 3, and had stated right away that she would jump at the next opportunity to be involved in the series again. I didn't even think she even had in mind that the 50th anniversary episode was going to be the one they would ask her to jump back in with. But I'm so glad that she's there.
If you look at it, though, I mean, it really does make sense. I mean, how big a part of the series has the Brigadier been? And you can't have the original actor, obviously. So this is the next best thing. I mean, this is the thing that's going to tie it into the classic series.
Right, and it also guarantees that we're going to have the principal involvement of UNIT.
Yes.
Which means that whatever the situation that's being faced is something that goes beyond just the doctor's and companion's circle of involvement. So whatever it is, it's large scale. Not that you didn't think it was going to be large scale in the 50th anniversary, but I'm seeing a little bit of support from my, you know, whiz-bang, you know, pie in the sky theory here.
Yeah.
I don't know. You got UNIT involved. Specifically the Brig's daughter, Brig being the only other person who was aware or cognizant of the fact the Great Intelligence has been around all that time. I'm just saying.
It's very, very possible.
Well, one interesting story that came out recently is that Stephen Moffat started talking about what would have happened had David Tennant stayed on for another year. And, I mean, this is a really, really interesting story, and I'm...
hair would have become 2 feet tall! It would have scared children from miles away.
No, he was saying that, you know, we would have started off Series 5 the exact same way, the TARDIS crashing into Amy Pond's backyard. So we still would have had Amy. You know, he would have crashed into her backyard, come out looking much the same way that the 11th did, you know, all rumpled and beaten and everything like that. And then he would, you know, she would have fed him and he would have jumped back in his TARDIS and flown off. And then when he came back as when she was an adult, he would have been perfectly fine and had absolutely no recollection of what happened. You know, this leading into the fact that when we first meet him, he's just about to die. This, you know, that was the end of his life. And then when he comes back, when Amy's an adult, it would be more, you know, it would be before that. It would be his first time meeting her. So we would be going through Series 5 leading up to what we learned in the 11th hour and leading up to his death.
Mm-hmm. It's still, it still fits the storyline too, because the TARDIS crashes when he regenerates to the 11th.
Yeah.
You know, they kept all those elements. I mean, like, it's fascinating to see what might have been, and it sounds a little bit more timey-wimey than the storyline ended up being.
It definitely seems more like what he fleshed out with River a lot. So, you know, it's kind of more the same. It just would have been a different face on the whole thing. You know, I think it could have been an absolutely fascinating story, but, you know, what might have been.
Well, then we've got a couple of pieces that are kind of related to the show in general. Take me through. I started reading the article about our granddaughter, and it was long.
Yes,
I'm going to say that one. She had a lot to discuss, and I'm just I want to get your take on. Well, I'll let you give the synopsis first, but then I want to get your take on how you think what her presence of mind is. You know, what her real intent is in doing this and coming forward with this information. So, can you feed us through?
Yeah, well, so Carol Ann Ford, the woman who played Susan, the Doctor's granddaughter in the first Doctor stories, came forward and said that the show ruined her acting career. She went on to explain it and kind of say that, you know, it was crazy. She was a pop star all of a sudden, and just like overnight was, you know, this cultural icon. And then she went into some of the details saying that, you know, they had promised her that she was going to be, you know, an action hero kind of person. She was going to have crazy and cool outfits and, you know, eventually wind up with like telepathic powers and things like that. And as time went on, they're like, no, can you be just a little bit more ordinary? Here's some plain clothes. Put these on. act like a normal teenager, and it just got to the point where she was saying, you know, I was showing up, saying my lines, getting paid, and going home, and it was just a job, and she didn't like it, didn't care for it, anything like that. Mm. So, and she said it pretty much turned her off of acting. She was like, it's not what she wanted to do at that point. So,
well, she also claims that people, like, she would try to do something more adult after that, and people would be like, I brought my children to this because you were in Doctor Who, so we figured you were, like, a role model. Which, I mean, if that really happened to her, like, that sucks. Like, I can understand.
Typecasting.
Like, yeah. So, but, I mean, I think a lot of people feel this way about the show, and, like, it definitely leaves a mark on you. So, I feel like she's whining here, because plenty of other actors have been on the show, and they use it to be like, hey, I was on Doctor Who. Like, they own it instead of
Look at Billy Piper moving from Doctor Who into Confessions of a Call Girl. Yeah, it's right. You can't really hit more polar opposites than that. If you're looking at Doctor Who as a, you know, strictly family show, and then, you know, something that's just this side of Skinamax, you know.
Matt Smith played one of her clients.
Yeah. Kind of crazy.
Wow.
So I don't know. I think that it's interesting to hear her take on it and to kind of get some of that background information that we don't really get in this far out. But I mean, it seems like the kind of stuff that they will bring up and start showing in the Adventures of Space and Time, the biopic that's coming out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's true. I'll be interested to see how they portray her there.
Yeah. But, talking about sexuality and things like that, there's been a lot of criticism hitting Doctor Who about the rising element of sexuality.
Yeah, and this is coming from the early stages. I mean, this was originally, the conversation stemmed from one of the original directors that we had back from First Doctor, Waris Hussain, and obviously, to a certain degree, you got to take this with a grain of salt, that was, you know, 62, 63, when some of the initial pennings and production decisions were made about where the show was going to be. It was, and as he admits, you know, it's a different era, but there's this sexuality that has crept into the show. And he's not just referring to the most recent episodes and things, but he's sort of looking at it as a whole in terms of the fact that there's, the companion relationships have changed. It's not nearly as platonic as it used to be. There's an element of snark and adult humor that has moved into the episodes to a certain degree. But I think to a certain degree, we take a show that has been under such a microscope for as long as it has, and it has progressed with the cultural landscape as much as any other piece of pop culture has. Yeah, isn't this just to be expected? Isn't this just a get off my lawn kind of a response?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, that's, if you look at anything that's been around for this long, I mean, that, yeah, it's going to change, it's going to evolve, and it's going to be blatantly more sexual just because of the way that the culture has aged in the past 50 years. Mm. But to a certain extent, I kind of agree with his argument. I mean, this is something we've discussed here on the cast, is, you know, we don't want to see the Doctor romantically involved with his companions. You know, this is kind of an element of the same argument, is that there doesn't need to be the romantic interest there. There doesn't need to be anything beyond, you know, beyond the friendship and the companionship. You know, I mean, some of, you know, Donna Noble is one of the, you know, top favorite companions that we've had in New Who, and there was absolutely, you know, the only romantic kind of stuff there was strictly for humor when people would call them a couple.
Well, yeah. That makes it the exception that proves the rule. Like, we love her because she wasn't romantic, because in this, right, for many years, it has been. We say this stuff all the time. This guy's not saying anything new. There is a rising element of sexuality, but I think people want that. I don't know.
No, that's absolutely legitimate. But, like I said, your curmudgeons are going to be out there. And to a certain degree, we may see the grain of truth, or at least the grain of origins behind some of their arguments. But take it take it with your grain of salt, that you're dealing with individuals who wanted to keep, as it even mentioned in some of the original interviews with some of these, directors and actors from the earliest seasons, where they were equating the Doctor in terms of his enigmatic nature to a Sherlock Holmes. And Sherlock Holmes being, you know, for some reason, if they're trying to imply that Sherlock was completely, asexual and not romantically interested in anything, I beg to differ. But so be it. I'm not gonna fight that battle.
Yeah, I don't think that he should be portrayed that way. I just don't think that, you know, pairing him off with companions every time someone new comes into the TARDIS is the way to go either.
Well, regardless.
Yeah. and then the last thing that we have in the news is not really news, but another 50th anniversary picture. But I thought it was the best one yet because it shows both 10th and 11th Doctor in one shot. And I'm super excited about it. But they're like, they're in their clothes. 10's wearing the long brown coat. And it looks like Matt Smith is wearing his last season costume.
Yeah, the tweed jacket.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because they were making such a poignant, well, such a specific point about the changing of the primary wardrobe being a sort of a change of his mindset. So now where are we in the time frame?
Right. What if this occurs hundreds of years ago when, you know, when he was 900 years old?
Couple hundred of his years ago. And you notice they're doing a lot of, and we'll get to this when we get into the episode. They're screwing around a lot with his age. They're just sort of rounding up or rounding down a lot. You know, I'm about 1,000 years. I'm give or take 1,000 years old. I'm somewhere in the ballpark of 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when we were in a town called Mercy, you were giving us very specific numbers, and that had us all in a tizzy because we wanted to know how long you really were away by yourself. Mm-hmm. You gonna own up to that or what?
Well, right. They're like, these people want to know answers. Forget it. You get nothing.
Yeah, it's like they're starting to throw it all into question and be like, you know, he could just be throwing that number out and he's, you know, he's actually only 75 years old. Who knows? You know, it's. Yeah. So it's, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if and how this plays out at all.
Oh, do you want to share this?
I do want to share this because it got put on me, and I'm not going to suffer through this alone.
Okay. So, we'll put it on the website. you can rate it for yourself.
This will be at in the show notes. Go to GallifreyPublicRadio.com/33. That'll take you right to the show notes for this episode. And in there, you'll see these pictures. One of our listeners kind of shared with us that he was asking me, he's like, have you played Lego Star Wars? Well, yeah, I've got kids. Of course I've played Lego Star Wars. All right, you know the laser targets? Now picture the interior of the TARDIS. And my only reaction was, oh, you son of a b-.
And how dare these targets look like targets?
And if you look at the walls on the TARDIS, they look exactly like the targets from the from Lego Star Wars. And it's one of those, you know, now you can't unsee it. It's stuck in your head forever, and you have to suffer just like I do.
Well, he needs to practice with his sonic spanner every once in a while.
Yeah. I was telling him, I was like, great, now every time I sit down to watch an episode, I'm going to picture Lego Han Solo or Lego Boba Fett going running through, shooting up the walls, and I've got to do this until they redesign the TARDIS again. And we're only 3 episodes into this one. I mean, that's not fair. You can't do that to me.
I think we'll get by. Especially if we have enough going on in the episodes as we have with these last two that we can pull apart and keep ourselves distracted. Long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, we had an episode that split the modern Whovian camp in twain. It was viewed, it was absorbed, it was reacted to, and the wars began. As we alluded to early in the episode, this is a love-hate episode, and I don't mean by storyline. I mean you either loved it or you hated it. I don't really know anyone who kind of sits towards the center on this at all, and I've probably talked just over the course of the last, let's say, 4 days, with 24 people independently, you know, not in group scenarios, the one-on-one conversations where I've listened to where they fall within these camps. And they're pretty emphatic about whichever side that they're on.
Mm-hmm.
How do we want to do this?
Well, we got some feedback, and we're going to – basically, the people who gave us this feedback are some of the only people we can find that are pro this episode. So I think it would be – we're going to give them a chance, their, you know, their points, and then kind of rebut them, because I personally was one of the haters of Rings of Akaten. I think we were pronouncing it wrong. He says
Akaten.
Yeah,
Akaten. Let me at least say this, though, before we start getting into this. Thank you so much for the overwhelming response we've been getting. It takes an episode like this to really pull people out of the woodwork, and we've been taking tweets and emails and text messages and phone calls and people banging on my storm door. And
we've just been getting bombarded with people wanting to share their opinions on it, because it is such a divisive episode. You know, you've got people that are trying to defend their position. So, we've gotten a lot of feedback, and so let's go ahead and start with some of the emails we've gotten. We'll start with the first one from friend of the show Soleil. He says that this is in his top five favorite episodes. And he goes on to give all kinds of reasons for it. We're going to give you guys the short version. So he says that the writing was stunning, and he quotes lines like, we don't walk away, but when we're holding on to something precious, we run, and we don't stop running until we're out of the shadows. And then, comparing the Festival of Offerings to Pancake Tuesday, and then, explaining to Mary, while the vampire is howling behind her, you are unique in the universe. And I've got to say, he's got a point. I mean, there were some really decent lines in here. And, the speech that we get from the doctor towards the end was fantastic.
Brilliant. Absolutely.
Well acted, too, because that speech could have been, it could have been cloying, but he did it well.
Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to say that Clara was great in this. Something indefinable happened in this episode that flipped a switch. And goes on to talk about how she really stepped out on her own, and while I understand where he's getting with this, this is the same thing that we said about Amy in The 11th Hour, that she went out on her own, took charge, stood down the doctor, saved the day when he wasn't able to or wasn't going to, and this is the exact same kind of thing. So I can understand if this changed his opinion about her, and I'm not trying to negate that, but it's nothing new. This isn't something revolutionary.
No. I do agree that this is something that did help redefine or open some opportunities for likability to the new companion, and that's fine. Notice, though, that typically in this slot, couple episodes, 2-3 episodes into the new companion, you have this, what I can only refer to as the Where Do You Want to Go episode.
Yeah.
Which is the, I've exposed you to the ability to travel forwards and backwards through all of space and time. Come on, let me show you something. Where do you want to go? And that's what you would expect this to be. They go to this, cantina on Tatooine, kind of a bazaar.
I have that in my notes.
yeah.
Very Mos Eisley feeling,
Exactly. But it becomes an episode where the Doctor sort of disappears for a huge chunk of it, and it's Clara on her own, which does accomplish, giving us an opportunity to sort of see her, kind of feel it out and see what our opinions are of her, when she's not, trying to snog the doctor or what have you, and all that flirting. Thank God is done. I didn't get a hint of it. But it also meant that we had he doesn't come back around again until the final 15 minutes of the episode. So we're missing that. That camaraderie that's here. Take my arm. We're going to go do something amazing together. And it wasn't there. So I don't know.
That's a really good point. I hadn't even thought, because we think of the companion in terms of their relationship with the doctor. So yeah, Clara was pretty likable in this episode, but this is Doctor Who, like, you know.
Yeah. Well, I have my theories as to why they did this in the script. I mean, I understand that it was kind of unusual for us to have something where a companion who's relatively new to our experiences is suddenly left on her own on camera for 15 minutes, but I understand within the construct of the episode why it was done. There was some calculating stuff going on the doctor's part through this entire episode, from the first minute to the last look before the credits rolled. He may not have expected things to become as intense as they did over the course of the episode, but he was setting her up. He was watching her very, very closely. And every time she wasn't facing him, he was staring at the back of her head, waiting to see what she was going to do. So, you know, the leaving her alone for the 15 or 20 minutes while she's running around with the Queen of Years was all planned, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so, because I mean, they never go in to explain where he was. You know, normally when he's gone, they at least make some kind of offhanded comment, and they never even tried that with this one. It was just, he's gone and now he's back. Accept it, move on. And so, yeah, I think there was probably something behind that.
Mm-hmm. You know, every time she was trying to make one of these decisions about, you know, should she part with her mother's ring and things of that sort, she wasn't facing him. She was looking down at her hand, you know, trying to make this decision, and he was just boring into the back of her head, you know, just waiting to see, you know, what is the object of significance? How much does it mean to her? Why does it mean something to her? And he's trying to figure her out. You know, this impossible girl that he has to figure out. So, I don't know. I'm going to agree with Melissa. This is not an episode that I would definitely put anywhere into my top rankings, but thankfully, I got enough outside of the story that made me feel like I got something out of it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to kick it to the curb, but I'm not going to watch it very often on rewatches.
Well, one thing that Soleil put in his email that I do feel like I overlooked, just because it's kind of become a staple. You know, you kind of take it for granted, but you know, when he, and I'm actually going to read this whole chunk here because I think he did it really well. You know, he says, number three, the doctor stands down a son. The whole of the episode leads to him making an impossible choice and confront something beyond measure without having a ready solution. They tried to underscore this, but I think the point is easy to gloss over. He had no plan. He put himself absolute unthinkable danger for strangers because it was the right thing to do. Because at its core, there was an injustice that needed to be righted, and he won't walk away. This was a doctor-defining moment for me. The fact that Clara returns to his side is a defining moment for her as well. And, you know, we get so used to that, you know, there's something going on, the doctor's going to fix it. You know, that's it. And when you think about it, I mean, they really did sell that point, that he had absolutely nothing going into it. There was no way for him to win, and yet he couldn't walk away.
It was a suicide move.
Yeah.
And he admitted it. He said as much, you know, paraphrasing that great monologue that he was given. He was preparing to hand it all over. That was a sacrifice. Yeah. But it goes back to the fact that because he doesn't understand Clara, because he doesn't have that puzzle figured out, and because he doesn't know what she represents or why she has come across his path repeatedly, it just goes to show that while he was prepared to sacrifice himself, she brought along the solution that he could not come up with. Simple, elegant, and well expressed. I would say if you were to take the last 10 minutes of that episode and throw the rest of it out, I'd be perfectly happy. Well, except for the fact that there's a whole science issue with collapsing that sun and now all the planets have nothing to orbit around, but that's beside the point.
But wait, now, so I want to go back to what you said though, because I don't know if this was like a suicide thing for the doctor. I'm not saying it wasn't, but because you were saying about how he, when Clara walks away, he's like, his eyes are boring into her, like it felt like this whole thing was a test. He admits that he's been to the planet before, and it's almost like, you know, what if he brings people there to see what they'll do? Like, I, you know, as you were speaking here, I started to think about that. And if that's true at this moment, I think he does have a plan. Doesn't he say at one point, oh, she said in the last episode, people always have plans. I think that he had a plan, and that plan was for Clara to come save him because he'd been watching her and he now knew what she would do. Like, I don't think he went into there as a suicide. I think that he knew that Clara was going to come get him.
I don't think so, because if you see, you know, if you look at his face when he realizes what's going on, what the thing is, I mean, there's actual surprise and tension there. He's like, you know, I may have made a tactical boo-boo, you know, and,
well, no, at that point, yeah.
Yeah, and then he has no idea what to do, and he tries everything he can, you know, and the fact that he's giving everything he has, you know, basically giving up his memories to this thing, trying to kill it, and the fact that Clara is able to come in and understands Infinity better than the Doctor was able to. You know, I think that was more a point of, you know, the Doctor not being able to, you know, look beyond what he'd been through already.
True. Yeah. But I think, you know, when he makes statements as he does about, you know, of everything that he's seen, of all of the, you know, I marked the passing of the Time Lords, you know, I was there until nothing remained, no time, no space, just me. And, you know, and he goes through all of this and he's just laying it all out. And it is painful, painful to listen to what he's going through. And I'm so, so glad that, and I can't, like I said, this monologue, it accomplished good things for me, which is why I could throw away the rest of the episode and still feel like I gained something out of it. I broke down listening to that monologue. It was that tough. And I've rewatched this episode 3 times and it hits me harder in the chest every time I listen to it, because it has the preamble where he's kneeling down with Mary and he gives that great tribute to Carl Sagan about being made from star stuff, which, and that story is gorgeous. I'm sorry. You know, tattoo that across my back because that's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And that gives him the impetus and the strength to be able to stand up and start to deliver this soul bearing dialogue where he lays it all out. But he makes statements of things like, you know, and it's all yours, you know, take it all, have it all, you know, and he's ready to let it go. He's ready to let it go. And he feels the pain. He knows that it's tearing at him and he's ready to make that loss because he feels that it's going to work, but it doesn't work. It's not enough because whatever this goofy great pumpkin thing is that he's squaring down against, I'm sorry, it did look like a great pumpkin. Which we never really get a good understanding of what the hell it really is, other than that it's a soul eater, is that it wants more than all that was. And Clara, with the elegant solution, comes up with the not was.
And a different leaf than she had last week. Did anybody else notice that?
Well, you know, the props disintegrate. You know, they get beat up.
She pulled that leaf out, and I was like, that's not the one she had in there. Irritated me.
Yeah, it's the technical stuff. Yeah. But it's, I think if nothing else than what I was able to at least gain from that segment was that Clara is the right companion to have at the moment because he has clearly not given up all of the pain and the baggage and the weariness and the torment that a man over a millennia old is carrying with him and continues to in those moments when he's put to task or when he's at his, you know, at his breaking point or when he's completely run out of other options. In this case, that's what comes back to haunt him. All of the loss, all of the loneliness. And she's not just a companion to offset that. She's filling in the things that he doesn't think of.
Yeah, which is what we always need from the companion. They're always there to offset the Doctor, to make up the spaces that he can't fill in.
Right. So,
did anyone else catch the reference to Omega when he was doing his little speech?
No, I didn't really pick up on that. No,
he says at one point, you know, I've been to a universe where the laws of physics were created by a madman.
Was that what he was talking about?
That's the only thing that I can think to fit. I mean, when he went to confront Omega in the in the third or the three Doctors.
Yeah.
It, you know, he went to basically a little bubble universe that Omega had made and held together sheerly by the power of will.
That's absolutely legitimate because there are paraphrases to everything in here. You know, I walked away from the last great time war. Yeah. You know, I marked the passing of the Time Lords. You know, I've lost things you never understand. I've watched universes freeze. We know where that came from.
Yeah.
I've watched creations burn, you know, obviously when the alternate universes collapse. So yeah, I mean, this is a nice little walk down history lane of all the horrible things.
I mean, everything he mentioned. Yeah, everything he mentions in his little speech, the reference to Susan that we get early on in the episode, you know, I mean, it's just chock full of references to the classic series. And I was loving it. I was eating it all up. I think part of the reason why that speech was so fantastic was in a huge part due to the music. I mean, if you sit down and you read it, if you sit down and read it, it's powerful. But if you sit down and read it while you're listening to that music, it gains so much more.
Interesting that though, in my opinion, was one of the only sequences of the score and the music from this episode that I liked. I really didn't like any of the choral singing or anything of that sort. I definitely did not like the long song or that aspect of it. For some reason, it just didn't click. Maybe because so much of it was just in very simplistic lyric English.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you do it in Latin or something, so it sounds like elevated. When I realized she was singing in English, I'm like, what?
But what they were singing was very simple too.
Oh yeah.
You know, go back to sleep, my lord. Do not rise from slumber. I'm like, oh, come on, you gotta just step it up a little bit here. You're writing some pretty lines. Write them into the lyrics too. But.
I was going to say, at the end, while the music was very beautiful, I don't understand how everyone there knew to sing different harmonies.
Well, okay, this is going to get me to another one of my kind of sticking points, and then we'll get back to what some of our other write-ins and call-ins and stuff have said. Was languages. The fact that the TARDIS wasn't translating for us here.
All right. The only thing it didn't translate was the barking alien.
No, sir. Go back and watch it. They're walking through the marketplace.
Okay.
There are tons of languages being spoken.
Okay. But
you could do even if the TARDIS was.
Yeah, I mean that was just a lot of background noise. Sorry, that's the only thing that was prominent that wasn't translated was the barking alien.
Okay.
So, but also she says the TARDIS doesn't like her. What do you guys think of that? That's
that's clear. That goes along with my whole theory about my sort of over encompassing theory about Clara and everything going on there. Granted, no, the TARDIS does not like her. The TARDIS doesn't trust her. At the beginning of the episode, when the TARDIS is putting all this information up on the control screens and he's screaming at the control panel, it's because he doesn't like what the TARDIS is coming back with. You know, you see the stuff flashing across the screen about these other iterations or other pictures of her, and all of a sudden it says, like, Alaska and things like that across the screens. Like, what the hell is she trying to tell him that he flips the monitor around and refuses to look at it anymore? So, no, TARDIS doesn't like her. That's legit. And the fact that, you know, you could argue, well, maybe that's why, you know, she wasn't translating for Clara. But we also had the barking at scenes when the doctor runs back to try and make arrangements for the moped, and Clara's not even in the scene yet.
Yeah, I mean that,
and they're barking.
That kind of felt to me like the, you know, oh, I speak alien. Oh, I speak horse. You know, I speak baby.
I speak baby.
Yeah, it just seemed like one of those kind of gag things that they've been doing lately. I didn't feel like it was, oh, the TARDIS is refusing to translate for it. I felt like it was just something they wrote in as a humorous thing, like, oh, let's make an alien that barks like a dog. Mm-hmm. It really didn't stick out to me as a pertinent plot point.
Right. Yeah, so, but it does go along with, Melissa, I think you're exactly right. The TARDIS not liking Clara is legitimate. It is verified, and I think it's poignant. Because the TARDIS is aware of some things on a strictly balance the scales level that the Doctor refuses to see because he's getting emotionally involved.
Do you think that the TARDIS not liking her is the reason why the doors wouldn't open for her? Or do you think it's the simple lack of the key? Like, she hasn't been, in this iteration, she has not been given a key yet.
I don't think that matters, because there's times when the TARDIS has not only allowed the doors to be opened, there's times when the TARDIS has opened its doors for people to let them in at a time of risk.
Now, see, part of that could be they've said that they're going, I mean, part of the whole redesign of the control room is that they want it to feel more like a machine, like a spaceship. You know, so could that be it, that they're kind of ratcheting back the personality of the TARDIS and making it a simplistic thing, like, well, she just didn't have the key to unlock the door?
If they were going to do that, then she wouldn't have thrown the line in that I don't think she likes me.
Yeah, but I could also see that being there as just something to throw some humor into the tension.
Yeah, but why personify it? You know, it's a little too,
yeah,
it's a little too much of a finger to the nose for fans that know.
Yeah,
I immediately tied it into the TARDIS not translating. Like, I, you know, now that you mention it, I'm not sure that that was exactly what they intended. But on first viewing the episode, when she said the TARDIS doesn't like me, like, they threw that in for a reason.
I don't know. I feel like this episode didn't have a lot in the way of story. I mean,
there were a lot of great thrown in lines, like the quick granddaughter line and things like that, where you go, oh, and then they don't do anything with it.
So anytime something like this came up, my instant reaction to it was to say, oh, that's just something they threw in for comedic effect, or just to make you go, what? You know, I wasn't able to discern, like, okay, that's a throwaway line, this one's pertinent. I just kind of looked at it and said, okay, this could be a really good episode of TV elsewhere, but it's not good Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my whole take on this episode. I think it could have been great. I don't think it was great for this show.
Well, what about some of the other positive arguments we've got? Like, you know, I'm sure Sully's got some other support there. We've also got Shooter had some very positive things to say about it as well. What else have we got that kind of goes against our poo-pooing?
There hasn't been an awful lot. I mean, people do have little things that they like, which, I mean, there's all kinds of little things that I liked in it as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It just, those little things, the whole was not the sum of the parts.
Did it feel like an RTD episode that Moffat came in and added some lines to for interest?
No, it didn't even feel like that. It just felt like somebody, you know, it felt like somebody coming in who had seen an episode or two of Doctor Who and thought, oh, you know what? I've got this really great idea floating around in my head. Let me put it into this template. It didn't feel like, okay, I want to write a really good Doctor Who episode. It felt like I want to write a really good episode and put it in Doctor Who.
Okay. Yeah, I sort of saw it as there were some very, very good moments, exchanges, even a couple of good, clever lines, you know, like, you know, the one about Pancake Tuesday and those things that are very, very, very kind of Doctor Who. And you know, we enjoy that sort of level of humor, or the more dramatic moments and the speeches and the things that really kind of, you know, get our goosebumps going and that sort of thing. But then they said, oh, crap, we need a story to bind this all together. We need to get Clara dealing with important memories because the Doctor's trying to figure out her past, so let's do something that has to do with memory. We need to get her off the planet because, you know, we need to do the companion in space episode, so all right, let's get off world. You know, and you start sort of putting this formula together. And that was the weak point of the episode, as far as I saw it.
Mm-hmm. So, what was it that Shooter had to say? Because I know he was one of the others that was very, very vocal about this.
Yeah, well, he really got into the whimsy of it, the fact that this was a real sort of fantastic voyage, You know, it was the getting off planet. It was getting us into new worlds and new races and new alien life forms and things, and all of the stuff about the star hopping that we enjoy about the Doctor from a sci-fi perspective, you know, apart from everything else. And he was wholly entertained by it. He also really loved a lot of the little things that we were getting about Clara, where we realized that, you know, there was significance to the leaf. Granted, it wasn't quite as significant as we thought it was going to be, but we got our answers. You know, and the some weirdness going on around the little backstory that we'd gotten with her parents, which I'm still not quite grasping everything that we were supposed to take away from that. You know, separating the red herrings from the diamonds in that is still proving a little difficult. You know, you were noting about things like the dates on the gravestone for the mother. Mm-hmm. Some other folks, you know, some Twitter followers and things have noticed some connections between some of the props that were used, things of that sort. I noticed that, you know, at that same kind of gravesite scene, and I was talking about this with Amy the other day. Did you notice that Dad is looking remarkably young?
Oh my God, I said that. I was like, is that her brother or something? And then I went back and watched, and it's the same actor.
He's supposed to be in his 40s. They put some, like, you know, gray hairspray stuff in his hair, and that was
not
it.
Not even.
It looks like blonde from that. Like, it's in the dark, you know? So he just looks like a younger blonde guy.
Yeah, man. She brought her boyfriend to the funeral, and so that's kind of creepy.
All right, now, the fact that there was so much emphasis put on the fact that, you know, that was her mother's ring, or that, you know, they were so upset at the gravesite, or, you know, that Clara's big thing was about all the days that were stolen, all the days that, you know, she should have lived and things like that. I mean, there's got to be some huge tragic way that her mom died to lead to all of this. Yeah, you know, it that you don't get that kind of stuff like, oh, well, you know, it was her time. You know, she died in a tragic way. There has got to be a story behind this.
Right. At age 45, so I'm doing the math on that. And the repetition of the line, and it seems like they were hitting it really hard with the delivery too. I'll be there for you every time. You know, right. She was you know, telling her the comforting story at age 6. You know, I'll always be there for you every time, and just keep, you know, banging the little girl on the head with it. I'm like, okay, well, significance maybe.
A bit.
So, again, you know, are they screwing with us? Are they just handing us more material than we can possibly digest so that we don't know which avenue to chase down? Potentially, sure. But there are too many little connections along the way. I don't know.
Did anyone else catch the, you know, her mom's phrase that she kept saying, you know, was, oh, my stars?
Yes.
And then at the very end, that's exactly what Clara says too. And I'm like, okay, is that something pertinent, or is that just, you know, she heard her mom say it so often that that's what she says? It's like, that was one of those things that did kind of catch me.
I also have that in my notes. Oh, my stars. Does it mean something?
Yeah. Well, did you have a theory on it? Because
tell us, please.
Well, it's just—I think it's just—it's a conscious decision that they've been making lately about being careful not to tread on religious subjects, rather than saying "Oh my God" or "Oh my gods" or what have you, which other shows will make their decisions about how they're going to fall on that sort of an expletive. You notice throughout all of this thing where they're saying, you know, they're praying to the old God. Well, is he a God? Well, that's what they say. It's a nice story. That's what they believe.
Yeah.
You know, the very careful treatment of that sort of thing.
And the funny thing is that it was so careful and so calculated that it really stood out in how they weren't saying anything. It was just like, you know, you're taking just a little bit too much time being cautious about this, and it's really making it a glaring, obvious thing.
I have to agree. I'm surprised here that you think that they, like, tiptoed around it, because I think that this was, like, a very – I'm still not entirely sure what they were trying to say, but there was something to be said about religion in this episode.
Well, I, I don't think it was a matter of tiptoeing around it as not to address it. I think it was a matter of carefully stepping aside of it so as not to muddy the waters with it. You know, it's like, all right, we want to make sure that this is at its core, it's a science fiction show. So we're not going to get into theology.
Yeah, it's an alien race, you know, worshiping an alien god, you know, that you really get no backstory on or anything like. So it's very easy to detach that and say, oh, well, it's okay for them to do that because they're aliens. It's, you know, that kind of. So they're trying very carefully not to get it anywhere near anything that could be construed as, you know, an Earth-based religion or something like that.
Right. Well, so that was kind of a sort of rolling back. That was Shooter's take, that it was really a matter of the whole whimsical element of it, you know, and he just loved the sheer fantastic nature of the entire thing. You know, and then you go and you add in the elements like the more comfortable relationship between doctor and companion that they established, that, as we mentioned, is not flirtatious. So that was something that we were able to positively take away from it. Doctor's speech, obviously, you know, the high point, as far as I'm concerned, of the episode. but then I did have to start to challenge him, even as he was sort of sharing some information with him. I had to buck him a little bit on the moped.
Oh yeah, the moped was
freaking
horrible.
Moped.
Oh, yeah, that was. I mean, first, really, yeah. And okay. So, is there atmosphere all through this space? I mean, is it just one giant atmosphere around this, or, you know, is there something special about this moped? You know, because we do get Clara's hair. This episode was one that you really have to say, okay, here's all of my understanding about science and how stuffs work. I'm going to put it over here on the shelf until I get done. Yeah, because, I mean,
there's
there was
Neil deGrasse Tyson. Oh, we got ourselves a badass over here.
I mean, there was so much in this episode that was a glaring, you know, contradiction. And when you have a show that is all about, you know, continuity and, you know, explaining things like that, or at least trying to give it something that sounds halfway feasible, you know, they wanted you to infer a lot in this episode, and that's just not what we're trained to do as Whovians. You know, we can infer, but then we're like, okay, I'm going to assume that it's this, but then in 5 minutes the doctor's going to give me some technobabble that, you know, will explain it.
Short on the babble.
Yeah, very.
But I do understand why they needed and I'm using both meanings here, the vehicle, the physical vehicle,
yeah,
and the script vehicle. Right. They needed something that was going to force her to make a decision about objects of personal significance and memory. So I understand that, because at one point one of the first watches was when I was down in the city this past weekend. Sorry, Melissa, I didn't give you a call. I was just down in the city this weekend.
Oh, thanks.
Well, we were busy. We were drunk at the time. But he's like, why in the world did they go chase after Mary with this stupid moped when you've got the far more capable craft sitting there at the back of the marketplace in the TARDIS?
Yeah.
And that's when I said, well, okay, well, they needed her to part with the ring, and he needed to watch her part with the ring for that significance and things. So, all right, they needed some other craft to get them from point A to point B across this expanse of space in the vacuum of time that shouldn't have had any air or freeze them to death or any of the other things that happens in the vacuum of space. But anyway, I guess that physics isn't important.
And if you remember in the last episode, you know, the doctor says, you know, I never take the TARDIS into battle. You know, and I think that that's probably setting up for something later on. You know, he doesn't want it falling into the wrong hands again.
Yeah. So he never takes it into battle except for the times when he does.
When he does, yeah.
Yeah. But man, did it have to be that moped? I mean, I looked at that and I'm like, that is about 300 pounds of wasted props.
Oh yeah, no. Just make it a little light disc from, you know, just that you stand on and it carries you. I mean, Yeah, how hard is
Disco
that?
Square. That would have been cool.
Photoshop, 10 minutes. I can do that for you. But no, you go and build that thing. Really?
And they always land at a skid. No one lands the thing gracefully. It was always... well, okay. Some of the other feedback. Have you got anything else from the positive camp? Or was it just our two lone gunmen there?
It's just pretty much the two of them. You guys are all alone, I'm sorry to say, but
I was soliciting positive feedback for 4 days.
I mean, like I said, they've got a lot of very good points. It's just they didn't total to a good episode, in my opinion. I mean, there was a lot of really good stuff, but it just didn't make it.
I think they could have just taken all of those little pieces that we enjoyed and they could have worked them into any other script and been just as effective. It's the story itself I just had the problem with, I think. And really very little else. All the other elements of it, what we gained from the doctor-companion relationship, what we got about Clara's backstory, what we got from some of the dialogue, great. I think the story itself just didn't meet our expectations. And from what I've been gathering from a lot of the Who forums and things out there, and some of the larger ones that take in a lot of ratings, sort of live time feedback from the viewing audience in the tens of thousands of viewers that contribute to these, and the overall index on this episode is one of the lowest in modern Who.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of the other feedback we got, I mean, it's all pretty much the same thing. We've got Reg, who says that, I thought it was good but not fantastic. Di said the speech was fantastic but I didn't love it. Listener Will Rum Daddy, he said, it was good but didn't love it. Abby comes in saying that aside from the doctor's speech, I didn't like it at all. So a lot of the same from most everyone that, it's like, it was all right. It wasn't horrible. I mean, I've heard people compare it to like Fear Her, and I don't think it's that.
Oh.
I think that's a bit extreme, but I do.
Or the Slovenes. I heard them say, I would have, at this point, I would have taken the farting aliens. Wow. Okay.
I mean, yeah. So, but I think that, there's some people that thought it was absolutely fantastic, and other people are like, it was a show. But then, you do have the Splinter group who's like, this is horrible. How dare they put that in my show? And this is, this is the downfall of Doctor Who, and, a lot of extremist opinions. Yeah. But
I think it's because they handed us an episode which was okay. Mm-hmm. At a time when we are expecting, because of all the hype and buildup that they've put to the latter half of the series, we're expecting swinging for the fence on every episode out of the eight to come.
Yeah, but I mean, this is something that we talked about, in our synopsis of the upcoming series. It's like every series really has has that one or two episodes where it's like, that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. In my head. And I don't feel like this is one of those episodes that I'm going to try and forget, but it's definitely not the home run that we've been getting lately.
Yeah.
When I go back to that's a fair point. Like they can't all be winners.
Yeah.
No. And I will go back to watch this because as we get other pieces to the Clara mystery as the series goes on, I'm going to go back and I'm going to reference this to try and see where I had been given some foreshadowing. Yeah.
And that's one thing I said to my wife when we sat down and watched it. We got done and she was like, well, that was a thing. And I was like,
that's a baby. That's a baby.
I don't plan on sitting down and watching this again, anytime soon. But once we get through the rest of the series, once we get closer to the 50th, maybe, I might go back and sit down and watch it just so I can be like, oh, I see what they did there, but right now it's kind of like they may be setting up the greatest story ever told in Doctor Who, but it just doesn't come across yet.
And now we get to sit back and wonder how long before we get the payoff.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, one thing that I did think about, you know, when Russell Davies used to talk about it early on in, you know, 2005, 2006, he said, you know, one thing he was trying to avoid was going to alien planets. You know, even though that, you know, it's part of the show is you're supposed to be able to go to these alien worlds and things like that, it's, you get there and, you know, you try and come up with this conflict, and it's very difficult to get the audience to buy in because it's a bunch of aliens. You know, and I really felt that come across in this episode where it's, you know, we're on this planet and there's this horrible thing going on. I'm just kind of like, eh, okay. So there's a story plot here. I couldn't emotionally invest myself. You know, it's like I had no connection with these people aside from like the little girl who, you know, at first I think she's in distress, and then you find out, oh, it's just stage fright. And at that point I kind of like checked out emotionally completely. It was like, eh, whatever. I'm going to watch through the end of the episode, but I just don't care anymore. And I mean, that really felt like the problem. It was a huge problem, is that, you know, had they put this on a planet of humans, or, I mean, I think it's great that it's not a human colony again, because they do that a lot. But had it been something that we knew or were attached to or something like that, you know, put it with some Ood or, you know, races that we've met before and have a connection with, you know, put them in there, and it would be easier for us to feel the tension and be like, okay, something's got to be done here. But here it's like, we're going to throw in a bunch of random Star Wars aliens that you've never seen before and expect you to care about it within 5 minutes.
Right. Maybe they're setting it up that we'll care, like, you know, we'll care about them later. Yeah, like, the Oods had to have an introductory episode.
Yeah, but you can't always say, well, you know, I'm going to write this episode and you're going to love it 2 years from now. You know, you're never going to get the show to continue if you keep doing that.
The ultimate way Homer. Yeah. Well, I don't know. You know, look to the next couple of episodes we're going to be handed, and just at, you know, at knee jerk reactions, see whether or not you've got the groundwork, or the capacity within those settings and scenarios to give you some of the things you think you're missing right now. I think they've made a very conscious effort to do a lot of jumping around with the final eight for this half of the series. You know, maybe culminating in the last two, but we're going to be all over the place, literally all over time and space. So I think if anything, we're going to see more repetition of this encapsulated episode that has little elements, little hooks to keep pulling us along our primary arcs at best. Mm. You know, we're not going to have, you know, the way we had, you know, when Bad Wolf really started catching its stride as an arc, and episode after episode were intrinsically involved with moving that story along. It's not going to be that kind of a centralized approach. It's going to be like this. Yeah. You've got a story that has hooks. But my question is, while we were agreeing that this kind of felt like a bag of hooks that they latched to a story, which is coming first?
Yeah,
you know, and that falls on the writers. So I have no question that Gaiman's not going to crush it, because I'm sure that he, you know, checked in at regular intervals with Moffat to find out, you know, make sure that he was, you know, allowing the right opportunities and hitting the points that he needed to for the arc. But do our other writers? I had higher hopes for this for our writer out of this episode.
I mean, well. I mean, this was Neil Cross's first episode that he'd written. So, and we do have one more coming from him, not next week, but the following with Hyde. So, like I said, I think that this could have been a really good episode. So I'm interested in seeing what he does with that. If, you know, if he can do if he can convince me with that one, then okay, he's okay in my book. But if that one's going to have a pretty high bar set for me. You know, it's like you've really got to step it up next time, or I'm just not going to care.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. There was one other thing that I wanted to talk about. The whole grandfather thing.
Yeah.
I think that they were consciously trying to make the link, because he says that he was a grandfather at the beginning of the episode, and then at the end we see that the old god is called Grandfather. And, you know, same episode, they're talking about that. I won't go like dark and say like, what if it is the Doctor or something? But like, I think that when he gives that whole speech, he might be like seeing part of himself in the old god. Like, because he, well, you know, I mean, we could talk for hours about that, but would you agree with that, anyone? Or know what I'm...
I did think that it was kind of interesting that they picked this episode to make reference to Susan. And then, you know, the villain is called Grandfather. Yeah, again, that could have just been, you know, it could have been Neil Cross saying, well, I want to make reference to the old show, you know, and he had Grandfather on his mind, so he threw it in there. It could go either way. I don't know at this point which way I feel like leaning.
I think they're continuing to slowly cultivate us for the 50th. I think all of these little odd lines and odd references that we're not really sure what their significance or what their poignancy is because they're preparing us for what's coming around the 50th. Or maybe that's just my hope, because I want that thing to be massive.
It definitely seems like we're getting a lot more of the references, you know, recently than we have been before. You know, I mean, hell, before this, the biggest reference that we got was, you know, in Let's Kill Hitler, when, you know, the Doctor asks for an interface and they show the stock photos of Rose and Martha and Donna. You know, and that's like the only reference that we got to things that happened beforehand. You know, and now it's like they're starting to come, you know, not only regularly, but really, really quick. So, I mean, there's got to be a reason behind that. And I think that it is that, you know, we're getting the 50th anniversary. They're going to start making references to all the old Doctors and things like that. So, they're trying to build up the interest. They're trying to say, okay, let's, you know, there's a lot of people who are brand new to the series who don't know the classic stuff. Let's start throwing that in there, get them interested in it so that, you know, they're up to speed when we start dropping the big stuff.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. All right. Well, my theory is still kicking. Yeah. I'm going to hang on to that damn thing for as long as I can. But, all right, well, we're headed into next week. We're dealing with the Cold War. We're gonna have soggy costumes for 45 minutes straight.
Yay.
And everybody getting, you know, really bad swamp foot and things. With Game of Thrones actors. So, hey, yeah. How can you go wrong? But I'm looking forward to this one from a sheer adventure standpoint. Not to mention the fact we'll have our Ice Warriors.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the draw for me at this point, is I want to see what they can do with the Ice Warriors. I want to see if they're able to bring them forward and make them relevant, or if it's just going to be another, like, hey, look what we used to have. Yeah. I really don't think that's going to be the case, but I'm very interested to see how this works.
Yeah, I
did think that it was very interesting how the coming next time thing was very, very, like, monster movie kind of thing. They never showed the Ice Warriors. The only thing you get is at the very end, you see the claw reaching for the button. Yeah. And I was like, you know, that's very, very monster movie. Like, we're just going to give you a tiny little glimpse to whet your appetite. But everything else is, you know, you're going to see everything that's going on, but you're never going to see it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the episode itself is going to play that way. Because if they do, and they withhold the actual reveal of the big bad until the third act of the episode, then that's very reminiscent of our classic Who.
Yeah.
You know, where you would go through three of the four parts of a broadcast episode without ever seeing what it was you were up against. So
exactly.
Yeah. Interesting.
And completely off the subject before we go, someone tweeted me that my picture that I was so excited about of Doctor 10 and 11 meeting is just people cosplaying. So I can't verify that. But I want to put the retraction at the end there in case it's true. Yeah.
If it is, then that's some really good cosplay, because they had Tennant's head down cold.
Oh yeah. Seriously, if you look at it again, it looks like the like it's actually from a scene. You've got them like separate, and you've got them each looking different ways, like, you know, like Tennant was wont to do, where, you know, he'd look one way and the other, trying to get all the information that he can. So
looking at this picture, it looks like them. I don't know. We'll leave it up and people can decide for themselves.
Hairstyles and physiques and that's
posture,
I don't know. I mean, there's not many people that can pull off that hair. I mean, David Tennant has the hair. So I don't know.
Well, regardless, I mean, we've got our other on location shots of Smith hanging from the door of the TARDIS on a crane and whatnot. So there's some cool stuff happening.
Yeah.
Envelopes being passed around, lots of pictures of Kate Stewart and our doctor being handed, you know, mysterious envelopes. Ooh.
Chills.
We haven't had any villains yet. We need more villains. Yeah. So, and granted, this is just one location shoot, mm-hmm. of right. which we could have dozens. Yeah. So, wait and see. But keep getting back in touch with us. Keep
yes, sharing we love all the feedback. Your stuff.
And let me just throw this out there. Just please be aware. We do our recordings typically on Wednesday nights. So if the episode airs on a Saturday evening, you've got a couple of days to get things into us. If you can help it. I know I'm making big requests. We're just now starting to see the sheer volume of response we can get from the listener base, which is great. Yeah. And don't let me ever sway you from ever throwing anything at us.
Oh, yeah.
But if you can get it to us prior to Wednesday, we'll have more time to digest and incorporate it into the show so that we can respond to you directly. So yeah, it's just a public service.
Friendly suggestion.
Yeah. Thank you to everyone that has written us, though. I mean, I've still got like half a page of notes that we were never even able to touch on just because we have so much feedback to go through. And I mean, that can give us more content than anything else, honestly. But you know, we love hearing everybody else's opinions. I mean, if it weren't for the feedback, we might have gone into this thinking that everyone didn't like it, you know. So thank you for sharing your opinions with us, and keep the stuff coming in. We really do love that.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, you know, send us emails at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You know, find us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio. You know, we're on Facebook. You can put iTunes comments. You know, go over to gallifreypublicradio.com. Leave comments on the episode itself. You know, gallifreypublicradio.com/33 is the way to get to this episode. You know, any way that you can find us to get a hold of us, just, you know, let us know what you think. Let us know why the show was the greatest / worst that ever existed.
And anything in between.
Yes, yes.
Well, you guys have any last words?
Moped.
Okay. Oh, you had to go there, didn't you?
I did. Stupid props.
I had almost forgotten them, but no.
All right, well, this has been episode 33 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, we do not walk away.
And this is Melissa, excited for Ice Warriors and Sir Davos next week.
This is Kira saying, so come on then, take it all!
See you guys next week. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. Have something you need to say, something we got wrong, or something you just need to weigh in on? Send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also find us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, on Stitcher Smart Radio under Gallifrey Public Radio. Find us on iTunes, where you can leave us comments and reviews. You can also head over to our homepage at gallifreypublicradio.com, where you can leave comments on each episode and get into discussions on the things that we bring up. You can also keep up to date on all the latest news and what's going on in the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2013.